It's time now for the Todd Leonard Show. Leave those negative stories behind as we focus on the positive and hear from those who give back and help others. Let's start your day with some inspirational stories. Now, here's your host, Todd Leonard.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in this morning. I hope everyone's enjoying this great weather. We have an incredible guest today, Paul Profeta, real estate entrepreneur extraordinaire right here in Essex County. And we're going to talk about his roots. We're going to talk about his love and devotion, really passionate, lift up Newark and the inner city community. It's really a remarkable story. Paul, are you with us this morning, sir?
I am.
Thank you. Well, good morning, sir, and we do appreciate you waking up and joining us early this morning. So, Paul, I gave you just a little bit of an introduction about your real estate background. Before we talk about your entrepreneurship and your really willingness to lift up Newark, which is, I think, vitally important for all of us here in New Jersey, I wanted to go back a little bit and talk about your roots and kind of where you're from and influences on in your life. You know, last week you had a Father's Day show, we had John McAlevey, and both him and myself shared really the importance of a dad in our lives and really heroes they were to us. I want to talk to you, if we could, about, you know, your parents and how that really grounded you and the roots that really have served you so well over the many years. So could you tell us a little bit about your upbringing?
Sure. I was raised in Maplewood, New Jersey. My father was an immigrant from Abruzzi, Italy. My mother was born shortly after her parents got here. They were from the same town in Abruzzi, and they got married. Their parents were close friends. Their parents were in each other's weddings in Italy, and they got married, and they moved to Maplewood, and I was raised there. And I attribute all of my success to my parents. I had the greatest dad.
And when you look back at it, you know, I'm relatively young. I like to think I'm young. My little guy just turned 6 yesterday, and my other one is only 4, so I have to be young. But I've looked back more about the impact parents have in my life, and obviously you're giving them the love and really the credit. When did you realize the importance of your parents in your life and how they really shaped and informed who you are today?
Unfortunately, it was probably my 20s. You know, when you go through your teens, you become a world expert in everything, and your parents are idiots, and they don't know what they're talking about. And I think I went through that stage like every young person. When I got to my 20s, I just started to realize what extraordinary people they were. My father, as I say, got here when he was 3. He couldn't speak English till he was 7. He started shining shoes when he was 8 or 9. At the turn of the century, we had terrible discrimination in this country. It was popular to be discriminatory. You were rated by who you would not associate with, and the longer the list, the more exclusive you were. So being Italian or Irish or Jewish or black prevented you from an enormous amount of opportunities, schools, jobs, places you could live. But he saw that the avenue to freedom or equality in America was education. And he worked full-time, but he went to NYU at night, and he got a college diploma, he got a law degree, he got a master's in law, and then he got, as he would say, a real PhD in law, because recently they changed the law degree to be a JD. But he then started his own law practice and then became a professor of law. All in one generation, getting off the boat to professor and having your own law practice.
Did your dad ever, you know, discuss with you how important it was for education to really lift the family up, or is it just something he did and you just, you know, I guess it was something you just grew up with?
Oh, God, no. It was. I don't want to say drummed into my brother's head and my head, but it was talked about after dinner. Other kids would be knocking on the door to play stickball on the street. We were sent up to our rooms to do our homework. If I got an A- in a class, my parents demanded a teacher's conference as to why I didn't get an A. And I think I ended up getting better grades because the teachers didn't want the conference.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, you know, obviously they set an incredibly high bar for you. And that's something I also wanted to explore, because obviously education was critically important for your parents, and they really instilled it in you and your brother. The importance of education, and obviously you've been following in your late dad's footsteps in terms of your commitment. How important do you think it's been in your life, them instilling in you the importance of really working your fanny off and getting pretty much A's?
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear the end of that.
Yeah, no, what I was just asking is, in terms of how it's really, you know, shaped your life, how important education was, and how they instilled in you the idea of excellence and not to settle for an A-, which obviously A- is great as it was, but, you know, in your family, they wanted more. How do you think that really shaped your educational process and your success?
Well, we were, let's say, educated to discrimination when my brother and I, when we were young men, and let's say growing up. And my father's phrase was, if you're educated, you can't be denied. And we would talk about schools, and they would make it clear that what they really would love us to do is go to Harvard or Yale. And that was part of the mantra. We really would love to see you get in. Not if you don't get in, we're going to disown you, but that's what you should shoot for. And my brother went to Yale and then Harvard Law School and then got a master's at Harvard Law, and I ended up going to Harvard and then Harvard Business School.
So where'd you grow up, in Maplewood?
Yes.
Okay. So the other folks in Maplewood, your other peers, did any of them make it to Harvard, or were you the only one?
No, oddly enough, we had, I'm going to say, four that got to Harvard that year.
Right, and then you went on to Harvard Business School and got your MBA, so obviously education was critically important. And what was the response of your parents in terms of, you know, your academic success? Did they seem satisfied with your tremendous schooling?
My mother had a bracelet. And every time we got a degree from Harvard, Yale, she would put an insignia on. You know, they sell those like their logo, and you can clip it on the bracelet. And I still have that bracelet. She called it her bracelet of respect.
Respect. What was the logo?
Oh, the logo would be either Yale's.
Oh, okay, the school itself. All right. So here you were, you went to Harvard, you know, got an MBA. And the question is, you obviously have the whole world in front of you. And one of the things that I introduce you as is a real estate entrepreneur, even through an extraordinaire, since you woke up early to be on the show. So figured I'd be a little gratuitous. But on a serious note, I mean, obviously you had tremendous education, tremendous opportunity. You saw your dad as a role model. I understand from some of the research I did in preparation of the show, your mom was a teacher and, you know, obviously a very good school system, a guidance counselor. So you had a lot of different opportunities career-wise. I'm always interested in kind of people's career paths because I followed in my late dad's footsteps as a lawyer. He was my hero, so that was my thing. And I hopefully carry on and make him proud to this very moment. But in terms of your career opportunities, how'd you get involved in real estate?
It's interesting. When I went back to business school, I thought I wanted to go to Wall Street, and I started by majoring in securities. But I never got comfortable with Wall Street. I mean, now, you know, what's recently happened is a great example. The S&P was at 3,300, and all of a sudden, Wall Street realized what the pandemic was about. It dropped in, I think, 10 days. It dropped a third. And then since then, in March, when it dropped a third, it's now marched back up to where it was. We have the same pandemic. We have all the same issues, but it swung a third down and a third back. And it's strictly emotional and, I think, a little irrational. I was uncomfortable with that. So when I was in business school, I ordered a real estate course, and I just fell in love with it. I mean, I'm going to say the first or second lecture, I realized this is where I've got to be. You know, you have a real asset, you can kick the bricks, You can go look at it. You can look at the parking lot. You can look at the elevator. You can look at the stairs. You can look at the common area hallways. You can get up on the roof and see if there's leaks. You can read the leases, and you can see what income you have and don't. You can check for taxes and utilities. I mean, you can do a real investigation of what this investment's going to perform like. And it's so much more grounded for me than Wall Street.
Well, did you have a mentor or something just stuck out, as you just highlighted for us, just something about real estate that just made you feel like that was for you?
It was that first professor. His name was Phil David. And he and I hit it up, and he said, you've just got the DNA for real estate. You should go into real estate.
And what year was that, Paul, that you embarked into actually, you know, real estate?
1970.
1970, wow, there you go. It's been a while. Been a number of moons.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
I'm going to be 76 tomorrow.
Well, there you go. So God bless you for a long career in the field. So in terms of the reason why I brought you on is obviously talk about what you're doing to, you know, give back to the community. That's the cornerstone of the show, is just those who just give back, not for the accolades, not for the pat in the back, not for the recognition, just good people. So let's talk about your philanthropic endeavors and really the first thing you got involved in and why you think you decided to, you know, show your humanity. Was there something that triggered it?
Yeah, my parents were very philanthropic, and they wanted my brother and I to be philanthropic, and they, you know, explained how important it is for those who can to help those who need help. And it's not something that you do in order to gain any praise or accolades. You just do it and don't expect anything in return. It's what good people do. We're here on this planet to help each other. And they devoted their lives to that. And I always promised them in my heart that I would do likewise. And I was on a motorcycle trip in upstate New York, in fact, in Utica, in 2007. And my fiance was on the back of the motorcycle. We were up there watching the foliage change. And we had a motorcycle accident, and the EMS guys came and put me on a spinal board and taped my head down. And I asked them why they were doing that. And they said, you might have spinal injuries. You could be paralyzed. We want to stabilize you. And the first thought that rushed through my head was, oh, my God, I never did the philanthropic work I promised my mom and dad. And all the way to the hospital, I just kept thinking, oh, how did I fail them? And I promised them and myself, if I got out of the hospital, I wasn't paralyzed, I was going to do something about that. So soon after I got into the emergency ward, they realized I wasn't paralyzed, and they put me in a room. I'd broken my collarbone. I'd broken my ribs in 11 places. And soon after I realized I wasn't paralyzed, I sat there and thought, what would be the most productive a charitable endeavor I could participate in? And I just tried to think it through logically. I said, you know, you're a pretty good businessman. Maybe you could help minority businesses get started, or if they're started, get healthier or grow. So I started the Profeta Urban Investment Foundation, and I partnered with Rutgers. I went to see the dean of the business school, who I didn't know. I just sort of got into his office, told him about the foundation, and told him I wanted to partner with Rutgers so that the students could help mentor the clients of the foundation. And so together we started, let's say, a partnership. The foundation had the money, and the school had the program, and the students would find merchants who wanted to either get started or grow. And they would work on business plan and help them. And then when they reached a point of, let's say, sophistication, that it made sense to help them, the foundation, to this day, loans them money at no interest and no amortization and no liability, you know, you say, my God, that's not a loan. Now, we ask them, when the business becomes successful, to slowly pay it back at a comfortable rate so that the foundation can use that money again to help the next minority business.
Well, that's incredible, Paul, that you got so involved in 2007. I wanted to go back, though. You mentioned your dad and your mom and how you grew up with really an altruistic family. Your dad, you know, did a lot, from what I understand in some of our pre-interview, discussions about what really informed your life. And you had told me your dad had a phrase. Do you remember the phrase your dad had?
Oh, God. It's tattooed on my heart. Those who can help should.
So when your dad said that, you know, and obviously it goes to your core, was that something that you realized the importance and how it would kind of guide you through your life, or is it something you kind of grew into?
I grew into.
You grow into it. So in terms of your dad and all the things that he did, you know, I talked about my late dad and you know, everybody that knows me knows how much I love and adore my parents and what they meant in my life and the examples they set. You know, that's one of the beauties of life is if you're blessed with great parents, it usually is a very, very important influence in your life. Not that people can't rise above it, but it certainly helps a lot if you have great supportive parents. Can you give us some of the things that your dad had done that you watched growing up that you were like, wow, my dad really is giving back?
He was always volunteering and spending time, and he had such a nice, gentle way. He was such a loving guy. He made it clear as soon as he started to help you that you couldn't fail, that he was there for you, and if you didn't get it right immediately, he was going to help you get it right eventually. And there was no win or lose. He was going to be there as your coach until you started to see it correctly. I was probably late teens, maybe even college, that I was home and I read the local Maplewood paper, and he's on the front page. And it's this picture and this big article, and there was a program that he was involved in called SKEEP. And it was a program where retired executives at the churches in Maplewood would tutor inner city kids in basics like math and English. And he had volunteered more time than all the other volunteers combined, and he was being honored. And I'd never heard of it. And I went in with the article. I said, Dad, you never mentioned SKEEP. He said, why should I? He said, because it's wonderful what you've done. And he said, yeah, but I'm not going to go talk about it. You just do it. And then that rang the bell. When I heard that, I realized when he says those who can help should, period, you don't hang around looking for an award. You just do it.
So in terms of, obviously, that incredibly important advice that your dad had provided and obviously his involvement with SKEEP, your dad had a commitment to the underprivileged kids in Newark. And I know, you know, we were talking also in the past about Newark and why Newark is so important to New Jersey and kind of how Newark was really the place to be. I remember my late grandfather, Papa, had the Clinton's Men's Shop in Clinton Avenue in Newark, and he used to regale me. He was the old school guy. He'd have a J&B mist and a cigar. It's kind of ironic. Almost every picture he's got a cigar in his mouth. We joke, we called it a pacifier because he always had it. But he used to talk about Newark and all of its splendor, and then, you know, sadly the riots hit in the late 60s. And the city really was reeling from that for many years, even to this day. And obviously, it's great you're so committed. But your dad's devotion to Newark and underprivileged kids, I know you talked about the Profeta Urban Investment Foundation that you created after, thankfully, in 2007, your motorcycle accident wasn't that catastrophic, so you're able to carry on with your life and help so many folks. But why is that? Why do you think you reached into Newark and said, look, I got to get back. I got to use my God-given gifts and raise the community up. Why do you think that was?
Oh, because, and I don't want to offend anybody, but in my heart, Newark was my town. I'm sure there's a million people that have, for different reasons, called Newark their town, and they're justified. But for me growing up, it was my town. It was common for my friends and I to get on the 31 bus on South Orange Avenue, go down to Newark for the afternoon, hang around. We'd hang around Bamberger's. We'd hang around Haynes. My first job was at Klein on the Square, which was on Broad Street. And it was just, it was our town. And we were down there for fun, and then we would take the bus back in time for dinner.
So I
just loved Newark.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I was thinking of Newark, too, when I was getting ready for the show. And I know my late dad and I, we toiled in Newark 744 Broad Street for years. And it got pretty rough there. My mom used to holler at us like, you know, you got to come home. We were basically running to Commerce Place to get to the parking lot, because if you didn't get there by 10, you were locked out. So I can recall vividly many a night we were scrambling to get to the parking garage. And obviously Newark, was an important and still is an important part of being an attorney. A lot of the greatest trial lawyers are in Newark, but many did migrate out of Newark for really security reasons. So when you got involved in the Urban Investment Foundation under your name and you met with the dean, you said you didn't know the dean. So were you, I wouldn't say scared, but were you wondering how he'd react?
Oh, sure. I mean, I was hoping he would be welcoming to the idea. And in fact, he just went, I don't want to say overboard, but he just loved it. And then he started, you know, I told him about the foundation. I wanted to work with Newark. And so he started a separate department called CUED, Center for Urban Education and Enterprise Development. And I funded that. I funded the, you know, to get that started, I funded the staff and so on. And we worked together. So CUED had courses on urban economics, and those students would mentor the merchants that we were helping.
So, why, you know, it was a great idea. And when I was learning more about it, I was like, you know, this is so important to have the community have own businesses, to be part of the community fabric of the success. I mean, there's no question everybody should be involved in their own community. What made you realize how important that was? Because obviously you were very, very talented in real estate. What made you realize the importance of what you're talking about, the mentorship and giving a hand up for the local businesses?
Well, the huge cause and cry today is police brutality. And it's a justified cause. It's something we need to improve. We need to eradicate police brutality immediately. But think about this intellectually, and please, I hope no one is offended by this, but if we could wave a magic wand this afternoon and eradicate police brutality, it still is not going to help some of the underprivileged people in Newark who are starving. What they need is not only good police. What they need is an economic opportunity. What they need is economic equality. And until this country has economic egalitarianism, we're going to have problems.
So, you know, you were touching on the local protests, and, you know, I just want to make it clear, anybody, if you're in law enforcement, that is abusing the public, certainly should be prosecuted, shouldn't be on the force, but there's so many wonderful, incredible law enforcement folks. So I also say, when people say defund the police, I said, that makes no sense. You need the police. I mean, obviously, there needs to be reform, and I think hopefully reasonable people would understand that, but I do agree there needs to be certainly many reforms. But once again, there's so many incredible law enforcement folks, and I would be remiss if I didn't show my support for law enforcement as well. I think they're vitally important. In terms of the youth, so I understand also you've been a professor at the highest institution in our land. What was it like to be a professor? I mean, you know, you taught a number of great institutions.
Oh, I taught part-time at Harvard Business School for 3 years, and then Columbia wanted to start a real estate department, and so I myself and two other adjuncts, which means we were in real estate for a living and did this as a something on the side. The three of us started the real estate department at Columbia Business School, and I taught there from 1980 to 89. And now I do a lot of guest lecturing at Rutgers Business School. But, both my parents were teachers, and there's not many settings in the world that I feel as comfortable as teaching. I am as relaxed in front of a class as I am talking to my own children. I just love it. And I love to field their questions, and I love to try and inspire them, and I love to try and get them motivated. And we built up the Columbia Real Estate Department to be the most popular curriculum on the campus, and in the business school campus, in 2-3 years. And now at Rutgers, I endowed the real estate chair, and around that chair and that professor, Morris Davis, we have created the Rutgers Real Estate Department, which is quickly growing. We've gone from no students to, I think, 800.
That's incredible, and I could tell from, you know, the way you're describing it. I think probably the reason why you're comfortable is you really know what you're talking about. You know, You have a niche in real estate. What is that niche that you found kind of your calling with all of your talent?
What is my calling in real estate?
Yeah, in other words, is there a certain genre of real estate that you've focused in where you've been incredibly successful?
Yeah, my specialty is what's called value-added investing, which is just a very sexy name for taking neglected properties, fixing them up, and selling them for more. You know, I look for properties that have not been maximized, that have been, neglected, and I try to make strategic capital improvements and then re-rent them for higher rent, and then with that higher value, sell them for more. Hopefully what I sell them for is in excess of what I paid plus what I put into it.
Sure. So is that something part of when you have an opportunity to lecture a mentor, is that something you try to pass on to the students?
Well, you know, one of the reasons that my teachings at I think, so popular is that they were not too academic. I would write cases about transactions I was involved in, and then I would bring the real live players into the classroom. So the students would go over the case, but then the real actors that it had happened to would be there and would talk to the students about, it didn't happen that way, it happened more this way, and so on, and they would hear the real outcome, and it just made it much more real than studying a textbook about calculus formulas.
No, something I'm thinking about when I was in law school, we really had a lot of case studies. They weren't bringing in the parties and litigants, but very interesting perspective. Paul, we're going to take a very short break and be back in 30 seconds.
Great. The Todd Leonard Show is sponsored by the Leonard Foundation, whose mission is to support the children and families who are battling pediatric cancer and those in need of food and assistance, women's shelters, and other important social services in the community. They also proudly support those fighting pancreatic cancer. They feel it's vitally important to help those in need in our amazing community when they need us the most. Please join them in extending a helping hand and go to leonardcharity.org and donate now. Together, we can touch many lives.
So welcome back. We're with Paul Profetov, the Urban Investment Foundation. He founded that a number of years ago and has done some incredible work. So, Paul, over the many years since you started in 2007 and got so involved and been so really dedicated and passionate about NORC and helping businesses with the hand up and creating jobs, how many businesses would you say you've been involved in launching through this really, really important program?
We've launched 15 businesses, which have created about 400 jobs.
Is that pretty much in NORC or NORC proper?
Yeah, NORC.
Unbelievable. I mean, that's something, you know, so important is getting revitalization into NORC. And as you talked about, the Broad Street area, Halsey Street, and all those wonderful areas really in NORC, it's something that I know when I go to court in NORC, I feel good when I'm driving around and instead of seeing abandoned buildings, I see a thriving urban center. So it feels real good to see that with a lot of the big firms that come back to NORC, which I think is great. So give us a little bit of a feel. So walk us through, if you have like a local business folk that really wants to be involved and needs your mentorship, needs your funds, and how much money have you put from your funds into the Urban Investment Foundation, would you say, over the many years?
Over $1 million.
Yeah, that's a big, big commitment. And in terms of, walk us through if you can. So let's say someone wants to have a coffee shop or something that, you know, you feel that you could use your expertise to help that particular business owner. Walk us through, what's the steps?
Well, I can, when you ask that, one jumps to mind because I just love this person so much. It's a woman named Aminata Duray, and she's from Sierra Leone. And she specializes in shea butter cosmetics. And I never knew this, but shea butter only grows in Africa. The shea butter tree or the shea butter bush only grows in Africa. And you harvest the shea butter itself from the, I think it's a nut that grows on the tree. You can tell I'm no expert in this, but she was running this business from her kitchen, which is a little dangerous because the shea butter comes in a like a big chunk form, and she had to melt it down so she could make it into shampoos and skin creams and so on. So she would have these big pots boiling on her stove, and she's not a big woman; she's like 5'2". And she would be carrying these pots of boiling basic oil around her kitchen and putting them in different spots. And if she'd ever had an accident, she would have been scalded horribly. So when I met her, she was selling the products from her house. She started just by selling them to her church. Actually, her mosque. She's Muslim. She started selling them to her mosque and then branching out to friends and neighbors. And he was starting to get her products into some stores. But she didn't have any money to buy the equipment she needed to do it professionally. So I met her, and she was clearly a hardworking person and clearly had the secret for eventual success. I mean, she had products that people wanted. And she and I became very close. One day, we were working on some papers, and I could see she wasn't reading them. And I said, Aminata, can you read? And she broke down crying. She said, no, I can't read English. And she said, I hope you don't throw me out of the program. I said, throw you out of the program? So we got her a tutor, and now she reads and writes English. And I went to Rutgers. Rutgers has a garage on Halsey Street, and there are three stores in the basement of it. Not in the basement, on the street level. And they had become not destroyed, but badly damaged by leaks from the garage down into the stores. So I made a deal with Rutgers. If you fix the leaks in the garage, I'll fix up the stores, and I'll put these minority merchants in there. And Aminata was the first one. So we built a store for her, and also in the back, we bought her professional equipment. And she calls it now Ancient African Formula. Yeah, she has her own website. She's very successful. She has, I'm going to say, 3 or 4 employees. And I just feel so close to her. She's such a wonderful person. And I love to go see her, and I bring my children there. And her store is just full of shea butter cosmetics in all kinds of forms, soaps, skin creams, shampoos. And then she's also branched into genuine, original African dress. So if you're an African-American woman, you go to the store, and she measures you, and you pick out a fabric, and she emails it to Sierra Leone, and then her family or friends of her family sew it, and then ship it over. And it's really genuine African garb. And she's done very well.
Well, it sounds like, you know, certainly you have a very close relationship, and that typifies, Paul, the kind of people you're touching and really improving their lives for the better. In terms of some of your other commitments, which I was really, because I'm an attorney, I found this to be intriguing, is the Rutgers Law Associates. And I think that's important for us to talk a little bit about. What's that?
That program has probably reaped more benefit per person than anything else I've done. Noor created a group called the Street Team. And because of the distrust between the police and the people in the South Ward and West Ward, they created a street team which was reformed ex-cons and reformed gang members. And they were, let's say, ambassadors between the gang members of those wards and the police. And very often they would find people that wanted to, as they say, come out of the fog. They wanted to start a regular life, have a social security card, and have a real name. Now, you know, people in the suburbs listening to this saying, what? Have a real name? What? If you're a gang member, you want to be off the radar. You don't have a real name that's on any list. You don't have a social security number. You don't have a driver's license. So what happens is, as things occur, there'll be warrants out for you. And you're living in this guy's living room, and then you move over to this guy's basement, and you're surfing. You're called couch surfing. If you now want to come out of that, and you want to start a regular American life with a job and a social security number and withholding, it's dangerous, because as you surface, all of a sudden, people know who you are, where you are. You might get arrested right away. So what the Law Associates have done, it's a group of recent graduates of the law school, and we help these people, as they say, get rid of the legal hair they have. A lot of these warrants are 5-10 years old. For example, there'll be a warrant for child support, and now the child's 21, so there's no more need for support. And we'll basically take this gentleman, and it's mostly men, to a judge, and get, you know, we'll do this on an informal basis and say, this is someone, he's got a job at XYZ, he's going to make so much an hour, but he needs to be able to lead a normal life. You got to give him a second chance. We got to get rid of his legal hair. And to their credit, these judges will remove these things from the record and give this guy a second chance. And it's changed lives.
Yeah, I mean, Paul, I mean, this is, once again, I mean, I'm thinking your commitment to Newark and being so involved, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're actually funding this too, this Rutgers Law Associates.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, that's really incredible. In terms of those individuals, so, I mean, you know, obviously you're a successful white guy. You're so involved in Newark, and you're dealing with some rough people. I mean, let's call it the way it is. They're former gang members, ex-cons. I mean, but how is that reaction when they get to see, you know, a successful white guy giving back and trying to lift them up? What's that relationship like?
Well, there's a real trust hurdle that you have to cross. I mean, African Americans that are underprivileged in the South Ward, West Ward, have a distrust of white guys in a suit. And they haven't been treated well, generally, and they, you know, there's a trust issue. So you have to get over that hurdle, and it's difficult. But once you do, you can really help them. I'm going to tell you a quick story about a gentleman named Habib. Habib, I don't think most people in the suburbs know what the gangs are. They think the gangs are just young men acting badly. It's not that at all. The gangs are surrogate families for young people that have no family. We know about fatherless homes, but there's a lot of kids with no home. They have no mother or father. They're living with relatives, and when they get to early 12, 13, 14, early teens, they gravitate to a gang, which becomes their surrogate family. And they often get into trouble, and there's no one to help them. And if you were there and you hear the stories that I've heard, you can almost sense a program, that this country had a program of just taking young black men and putting them in jail. You know, get them off the street. They're only going to cause trouble. Just put them in jail. So there's a gentleman named Habib, and I don't want to say his last name because I don't have permission, but he's a close, close friend of mine. And he witnessed a murder, and he had nothing to do with it, had no weapon. He just was standing there when it occurred. And the police asked him to give up who the shooter was. Now, if you give up the shooter in Newark, you're going to be dead in about 10 minutes. So, of course, he didn't give up. The shooter was a member of his gang. So, of course, he didn't give up the shooter. So, he was convicted of being an accomplice, having accomplished nothing. The guy is the sweetest, most gentle guy. He just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, you think, Todd, if something like that had happened to you, your father would have been in the prosecutor's office in a heartbeat. They would have gotten a famous litigator. They would have done everything they could, and you would not have gone to jail. Habib had nobody, had no assets, had no parents, had no friends of influence, and he went to jail for 16 years. Think about that. He's 18, and his whole youth is just stolen from him because he was standing in the wrong place in the wrong time. I mean, it makes me cry when I think about it. What was lucky for Habib was that a wife of one of the famous educators at Rutgers was teaching in the prisons, realized how smart he was, helped him get paroled, and got him what's known as a free ride at Rutgers, got him a scholarship. He ends up specializing in real estate, and I get to know him. And we are able to get over that trust thing. And I mentored him. And this spring, late winter, early spring, he said that he was just panicked because even though he was getting his MBA, he was sure he'd never going to get a job because he was an ex-con. And I said, excuse me, I get a little emotional. He said, we can get over that. We can get over that hurdle. And I called friends in the real estate business who had a sense of humanity, and I told them what a great guy this was. And I would say right up front, look, I got to tell you the bad news. He's an ex-con, an accomplice for murder. But I'm telling you, if you give him a chance, if you meet him, there isn't a murderous bone in his body. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy, and I will personally vouch for him. He got a job with a big development company, and he probably writes me every 2 weeks how grateful he is, how wonderful he feels. He feels like a regular American now. He feels like he's put all that behind him. Excuse me.
No, listen, I mean, I can see that Habib means the world to you, and it shows the kind of person you are, Paul, to be so giving and really try to lend a hand up. I'm a big believer in that, and I would just say that that's really a blessing that you're able to reach into Habib's life and basically do the right thing for him and your colleagues also, because I have to imagine if you lift Habib up and he's an example now for the community on the good things that can happen. I think that's wonderful that you've been, you know, so generous with your heart and your colleagues as well. I mean, we love success stories. And Habib, has he been able to reach up maybe and help some of his friends up and show them the path?
I don't know. I know that he's working as hard as he can. I actually, now that I think of it, I have met two other gentlemen through Habib who also had records. And one I was able to help. And this is the tragedy the heartbreak of working in the inner city. One I was able to help, and I got him into Rutgers, and I gave him a job in one of my companies, and all of a sudden, he disappeared. I mean, he was doing great. I helped him get on a diet. He was overweight. I was getting him organic food from my farm, and all of a sudden, he disappeared. And so I called Habib, and I said, Habib, where did Nathaniel go? And he said, he went back on drugs, and you'll never find him because he owes the drug dealers money, and he's hiding, and I don't even know if he'll be alive in 2 weeks. So that can happen. I mean, you can work and pour your heart into somebody, but they have such fragile, fragile backgrounds with no parents. And Nathaniel never saw his father, and his mother was a drug addict. And he, from age five on, he would just lived mostly by himself. I don't know how he told me that. I don't know how a five-year-old lives by himself. His mother would come and put some food in the pantry, and he would get himself to school and back. I don't know how you do that at five, but he did. But then he went back on drugs, and I've lost all touch with
him. Yeah, well, let's hope he resurfaces and turns it around and gets back on the straight and narrow. You know, that's one of the things, though, Paul, is you're going into the community, and you're doing your best. Now, let's talk about, because I know you're very successful, you've been pretty modest today about your real estate success, but how about your other colleagues? You have other folks that feel like you, that we got to lend a hand up. You know, I had the Interfaith Food Pantry on, had Carolyn Lake and Nathan Umbriak and Margaret MacBohm, and we talked about, you know, lending a hand up, and I know nutrition is really important to you, and I'll get to that in a second, but your other colleagues, are you setting an example for them? Like, hey, Paul Perfetta's doing it, maybe we can do it.
You know, there's never been anything I've approached people about that I've gotten such what I call a binary reaction. It's like a light switch. There are people that are philanthropic in their heart, and all you have to do is ask them. You don't even finish the sentence, and they're like, oh, yeah, I'll help you with that. Oh, yeah, I'll do that. They can't give enough. And then there's others that say, I really don't have time. And I don't care how long you talk to the others, they're not going to give you a minute. They're too consumed with themselves and their own issues, and they don't have room in their heart and their life for philanthropic things. And I'm not looking down on them. I've been in that position myself at times, but at the time I'm approaching them, they're not able to help. But the ones who want to, it's almost unlimited.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty fascinating what you just touched on. Some people, you mention it, and it lights a trigger inside, and off to the races they go. Others, all right, that's great, but you never really hear from them again. I mean, that's just life's mysteries. In terms of the balancing, though, Paul, because, I mean, obviously you have a family, you have a thriving real estate business, and you're so involved, you know, in giving back to Newark in these various causes we're discussing this morning. Do you ever think about just, like, how do you even jam the time in?
I'm having so much fun that it is. I don't think of it like that. I've never been so consumed. I've never had so many causes, and I love every minute of it.
Well, that's great that you have that spirit. I can certainly hear it in your voice today. I wanted just to talk a little bit, you know, and we're having a great conversation with you, is your involvement with nutrition, especially in Newark with the food pantry and with your organic farming. I know my wife loves organic food and swears by it. How'd you get so involved in nutrition and organic farming?
My fiance, who became my wife, is a certified nutritional counselor. And just being with her, you know, we would sit down to eat something and she would tell me the ingredients in it and so on. You slowly, gently get to learn how infected our conventional food supply is. And the things you're putting in your mouth are just not healthy. It's not that they're not healthy. They're unhealthy. The average fast food burger is about a third pink slime. That's a whole story. That's not for this show, but anybody interested, Google pink slime and you'll see what you're eating. The chicken nuggets are one-third sawdust. People think the shakes are milk and ice cream. It's such a joke. If they were, they wouldn't call them shakes. They'd say ice cream. They are aerated oil that's been chilled and chemically colored and chemically flavored to reflect whatever you want. You want a chocolate? There's no chocolate in it. It's chemicals. You want strawberry? It's strawberry. So you start to hear that and you start to think, oh my God. And then you start to relate it to the rise of autism and obesity. You start to realize this country has a nutrition crisis that no one talks about. A third of the country is morbidly obese. Two-thirds are overweight. And unfortunately, and this is tragic, the worst epidemic is in the inner city because they don't have the opportunity to get healthy food. Cory Booker would call Newark a food desert. I don't know if it was his term or he was using someone else's, but Newark is a food desert. You can get Popeye's chicken, you can get burgers anywhere, but you can't get good healthy food. You can't get a salad, you can't get vegetables. So what does that lead to? It leads to hypoglycemia and heart failure. It leads to diabetes and eventually, you know, it leads to kidney failure. So Newark needs healthy food more than most places, more than the suburbs. And it doesn't have the opportunity to get healthy food. So that was another program. I had a farm out in western Jersey, out in Hunterdon County, in the town called Reddington on 202. And my wife and I decided we were going to solve that problem. So we got certified organic, which took a lot longer and cost a lot more money than I ever thought. It took 3 years. But we were certified organic. And I wanted to create a program with the Baptist churches in Newark, where we wouldn't just bring the food to the church. The church would start a educational program for the clients of the church and show them how to cook these foods and how to enjoy these foods. These foods can be tastier than fast food because they're freshly picked and they're bursting with flavor. So I wanted to establish that program through those churches. Most of those churches have big kitchens in the basement because they have a lot of social events circulating around the church. And we just got started. We just got into a few food pantries and the pandemic came. But that's number one on my list for when we're able to open up again, so to speak. And I really want to bring good food, healthy food to the people of Newark.
No question. You know, Paul, and I'm remiss. I didn't give you a chance to give the listeners, if they want to reach out to you and talk to you about your various philanthropic endeavors, talk to you about organic food. I'm glad my wife makes me watch my diet, so I feel good about that now. We have these discussions all the time. So how would someone reach out to you, Paul, if they wanted to talk about your wonderful causes in Newark and about organic food?
Well, if they want to talk about organic food, they go to ProfettaFarms.com. ProfettaFarms, one word, .com. And that's pretty easy. If they want to talk about the Profeta Urban Investment Foundation, they want to volunteer time, they go to the Profeta Urban Investment Foundation website, and you can click on volunteer. You can click on a lot of things. You can see the merchants that we've helped. You can see the testimonials. You know, we have opportunities to, you can contact us through that and talk to us.
Yeah, can you say that one more time for the folks that want to get involved and give back in Newark and lift Newark up? Because there's a lot of wonderful people in the air, and they probably feel like we do, today, that we want Newark to be the Renaissance City again. We want it to basically be that such a thriving urban center, really a wonderful location. How do they reach you again?
Profeta Urban Investment Foundation website. It's all one word, Profeta Urban Investment Foundation. And I'll tell you one more thing about Profeta Urban Investment Foundation. A lot of charities have high overheads, and a high percentage of the dollar that you give goes to supporting the staff. Profeta Urban Investment Foundation, everybody volunteers their time. We don't have an office. Well, we have an office. It's my real estate office, but we don't have a separate office for the foundation. We don't have separate staff. We have an hourly worker who goes from merchant to merchant every month and helps them with their books and checkbook and does financials for them. And I pay her by the hour. And that's it. That's the only overhead. The rest of every dollar goes to the cause.
Well, I think that's really important, obviously, for everyone to know how committed you are to it. Before we end, you know, our interview this morning, Paul, what's your thoughts about Newark in the future? I mean, obviously, with the civil unrest and the protests and with the pandemic, I mean, it's been a perfect storm. I mean, I know New Jersey, thankfully, Governor Murphy's done a great job to try to flatten the curve, but throughout our great country, there's a resurgence, and we're all probably very concerned about having a comeback here. We got clobbered. What are your thoughts about Newark in the future? Where do you think it's going?
Well, I think I'm proud of Newark, the way the Black Lives Matter demonstrations have gone. There's been minimum of violence. There's been a cooperation between the demonstrators and the police to close streets, allow them to demonstrate peacefully. I mean, if you want to demonstrate and you want to have an effect, I think the wisest, most effective way is to demonstrate the way Martin Luther King did, peacefully, and your message gets heard. When you get violent, it engenders other emotions of observers, and you don't want that conflict. You want people to focus on Black Lives Matter, and that's the issue, and we have to improve that. So I'm proud of the way that Newark has acted. I think that Newark has a tremendous future. Newark has several interstates that run through it. Newark, you know, I in my real estate classes, I would ask people what creates value, and they all say location, location, location. I say, okay, so I've got this city in mind. It has the biggest port on the East Coast. It has the most active airport on the East Coast. It has four or five interstates. It has local rail. It has Amtrak. It has the whole court system for that section of the state. What is it? And they'd all look at me perplexed. They wouldn't know. I'd say Newark. And I go, whoa.
Right. Yeah, yeah. There's no question. I mean, Newark is so many great attributes. And Paul, I agree with you. I do hope and pray Newark continues on the right track. I think gentlemen like you really elevate the community. I would just say, Paul, you're really a blessing to Newark and really throughout this great state and to your family. I'm so happy you were able to join us. Before we conclude, I just want to let everyone know next week we're going to have Trooper Richard Tabor on the show, and he comes from Elizabeth, and he's really lifting up the community as well as a shining example of all that's good in the inner city and lifting everyone up. So everyone, just enjoy the rest of today. We're in this together, and remember to take care of each other. Look forward to having you tune in next week. Take care.